Today's podcast is sponsored by Fire Facilities Incorporated, expert engineers, designers, and manufacturers of steel training towers, burn rooms, and mobile units that are all made in the USA.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm fancy, dude. I know you're fucking around.
I like it. It's good.
Welcome back to 3 Point Firefighter. Today's guest is a big one. It is Captain John Cirillo. Now, Captain John Cirillo has been with FDNY for over 34 years. He is currently the captain of Rescue 1 in Manhattan, and he was involved in FDNY's research of wind-impacted fires and modern ventilation concepts from the very, very beginning. He's also an ISFSI instructor. It's kind of hard to even say my own
company. I always get it wrong.
Where I've met John teaching with, and then also an Underwriters Laboratory Advisory Panel member. Now, he's probably most proud of his lovely bride, Laura, and his wonderful daughter, Lucia. Brother John Cirillo, thank you for being on 3 Point Firefighter.
Jake, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
Good to see you again, buddy.
Yeah, man. Yeah, absolutely. We had a great time in California on the left coast, but we loved them dearly.
That was a really good class, wasn't it?
Yeah, I thought it really, really went well. The students were very engaged. Throughout, the late afternoon is always a little bit of a challenge sometimes, and they stayed engaged, and I was impressed. But I get impressed a lot where I go. You know, it's especially coming from this city, we get so FDNY focused sometimes. We don't realize that there is a big, beautiful country out there, and there are dedicated firemen and firefighters and firewomen everywhere we go.
Right. You know, so. Now, I will say this for those. That are listening, when we're out teaching, we did something a little different. We were taking half hour breaks after every live burn, which to John's point, it kind of made the afternoon go on a little longer than we probably wanted. But wherever John was going, he had a little tiny group of people that constantly followed him. And I imagine they were just picking your brain for being an FDNY firefighter, but a Rescue 1 captain is a pretty big damn deal in the fire service. So how many of those guys just kind of kept asking you.
They were, but I would say most of the questions were fire related. You know, it wasn't, questions, like Buffy questions about like nonsense. I know they were all very pertinent. Quite like, how do you guys do that? Or, you know, and again, you as everyone knows, when we have the manning levels that FDNY have, we could do a lot of things that other departments can't do. However, whatever needs to get done, as long as you have a little bit of a priority list, and then you just do with what you can with what you have, the job will get done. But it's to me, it's more of a mindset of what needs to get done as opposed to who's doing what. But no, the questions were fantastic. And I even we get a lot of visitors, obviously not so much over the last 2 years with COVID, but on a normal world, which we're heading back into, thank God, we get a lot of guests at the firehouse all the time. And I always, and my members of Rescue 1 are fantastic at giving everybody a little bit of time. And obviously, we have some busy days and we can't spend hours and hours and hours, but we always give a little nickel tour of the firehouse and we show them what we do. And we let, if they want to go up in the rig, they can check the rig out and whatnot. So, you know, so I'm kind of dialed into that. So no matter what the question is, I don't care where it is or what it is or who it is, like I'm going to give you my best assessment. Or if I don't know something, I'm going to say, listen, I don't really know too much about that, you know.
When we were at L.A., there was a couple of cool things. I got to open up a wet barrel hydrant, which 28 years, I've never done that. I've been dry barrel. So I was all excited about that. I don't think anybody around me was excited about it, but I was like, this is cool. And then I got to wear L.A. yellow gear for the fire. Yeah. And then I looked over at you, and you had an L.A. helmet on. John Cirillo with an L.A. helmet on.
Absolutely. I'm very proud to wear that again. What's really funny is the first time I at FDIC, I worked with a couple guys, a couple Chad's guys from and Jimmy Goldzinger's guys from LA County. And so we started talking back and forth. And I think that day I put on their jacket, their helmet too. And as proud as we are of our leather helmet, even though the FDNY, we're not wearing leather helmets anymore, but we're wearing a replica of a leather style habit, a traditional style helmet. They are equally proud of theirs because it's their identity. When people see that firefighter in that helmet, they're like, oh, that's LA County. Right. They know him right away. Now, people have to realize, too, that if you're wearing a I forget what the pounds are of a leather New Yorker now, right? And you're going to fight a wildland fire, you're not going to wear that helmet all day. It's just not going to be comfortable. The helmet they have is very comfortable. So they use it for structural firefighting and they use it for wildland firefighting. Yeah. God bless them. It's all good.
Serves a good purpose. Serves a good purpose. Yep. So why don't you tell me a little bit about how you got into the fire service and where you are now and how you ended up there?
Pretty simple. A lot of times when I teach, I'll tell people, I'll say, listen, the reason I'm a New York City firefighter and you're not is I grew up, 15 miles outside the city. If you're growing up, 15 miles outside Sacramento and you want to be a fireman, that's probably where you're going to be a firefighter. You know what I mean? However, we do have a tremendous amount of people on the FDNY that come from other parts of this country, if not the world, which blows me away, But I was 15 miles outside, small town, Roslyn Heights. And my father, first generation Italian, one of his probably greatest moments was when he turned 18, he joined the volunteer fire department in Roslyn. All right. So I guess that was in 1947. And he loved the fire service. He really did. Now, he owned a service station in town, him and his brother. So he was able to leave the station and put his brother Nunzio. Yes, there's people that are called Nunzio, right? I mean, in the Italian world, right? My uncle Nunzio was a wonderful man. But he'd leave the shop and go, do the volunteer firefighting thing. He loved it. So I grew up in that environment, right? Christmas parties and all of the volunteer world, right? When I was maybe 17 or 18, I had a cousin that was on the FDNY, and he said, hey, the test is coming up. I'm like, the test for what? He's like, oh, the New York City Fire Department. I'm like, oh, gee, let me take it. And I took it at 19. And there was a lot of things going on back then. Recruitment and whatnot. So I didn't get hired till I was 25. But when I got the letter to say I was going into the Proby Academy, my father hid the letter. And we went out to dinner for his 29th birthday, January 29th of 1988. And at the dinner, he handed it to me. And he said, son, I wish this was me. And he handed me the letter that I was accepted into the academy. And I started February 18th of 1988 as a New York City fireman. Wow. So, back in 81, I joined the volunteer. So that's right. I cut my teeth. I did, and then became a New York City fireman in 88. So that's basically it. Pretty simple.
So where did you start and how did you end up at Rescue One?
So, good question. Wow. That's really good. So I started in a wonderful engine company, Engine 225, Faithful Fearless on Lincoln Avenue in East New York, section of Brooklyn. So here's a Long Island kid getting thrust into, if you know Brooklyn at all, East New York is one of the downtrodden parts of Brooklyn. Good amount of fire duty. And I was there, assigned there through my cousin, was able to get me there, which is, I really had nowhere to go. I didn't know enough about the city to know where to go. And I'm very happy that I did land there. So I did 10 years in that firehouse, but loved it, enjoyed it. However, I was looking for something different. I probably would have transferred to another part of the city, but then the job came up with this concept of they were going to expand special operations and form a bunch of squad companies. And the Commissioner Feehan at the time had a thought that no matter what the situation, a battalion chief should always have a go-to company. And normally that's the rescue. But the rescues, there's only five of them. And if there's like a dive job in Manhattan, you can have Rescue 2 and Rescue 1 in Manhattan at a dive job. Who's covering Brooklyn? There was Squad 1, which was like an enhanced engine back then. But anyway, they expanded the system. And I could have went to Squad 252, which was pretty close to 225 in Bushwick. I knew the captain. He asked me to come there. But I actually said to him, I'd like to work in Manhattan. And the reason for that simply was I wanted a change of pace. I wanted to see a different part of the city. And some of really respected people I work with had said to me, you're really not a New York City fireman unless you work in Manhattan at some point in your career. That came to be true. So I asked the captain of 252, could he speak to Jerry Tracy, who was going to be the new captain of Squad 18 based in West 10th Street in Lower Manhattan. And I was lucky enough. They had tryouts and everything. It was pretty crazy the way that whole thing went down. But I was chosen out of a whole bunch of people, and I was assigned to Squad 18. the inaugural club, you know, group that went to Squad 18. It was phenomenal. So that's what got me into SOC. Right. All right. And then, you know, unfortunately, well, I probably would have made it to Rescue One anyway, but the events of 9/11 accelerated my transfer. After 4.5 years, I went uptown to Rescue One. Obviously, all the SOC units, including Squad 18, they lost 7. Rescue One lost 11. And so the units were decimated. And early 02, Paul Hashagen, who's a senior guy in Rescue One, had called me and said, hey, would you want to come up to Rescue One? And I said, I would, but I can't leave Squad 18 right now. We were rebuilding a company. I think I had a duty to stay there a little bit longer. And then towards the end of the year, Captain Bobby Morris called me and asked me to come up to Rescue One. And which, you know, what could I do? Bobby Morris is a wonderful captain, a wonderful man. You know, I think the world of him. And he saw something in me to come help, you know, rebuild Rescue One. And I consider it a complete honor to even be thought of in that vein. So late 02, I went up to Rescue One as a firefighter and spent, I was there until mid 05 when I got promoted to lieutenant. So that was my.
Oh, so you came up through the ranks on Rescue One.
Correct. I was a fireman there from late 02 to mid 05. Yeah.
Holy cow. Worked then lieutenant, then run captain.
Right.
So they let you stay when you get promoted. You can stay with the company you were promoted.
No. So as a lieutenant, so it's really funny how it went down. So now I make lieutenant, and you get sent to the regular world again. You know, which and listen, the regular world is fantastic. You know, Will, and when you're in SOC, you kind of. You know, we'll break chops on the other units. The other units are phenomenal. And they're the companies that are first do it boxes and making a difference and making grabs and, you know, going to medal day. They're incredible. We have a little bit of a different role. But anyway, so I go into the field and I'm bouncing in up in the Bronx. I never worked in the Bronx. So I asked Captain Morris to get me up to the Bronx. I like a challenge. So I could have went back to Brooklyn, back to a division I knew well. No, let me go somewhere different. And the Bronx is very different. And I enjoyed, I was up there for about a year. And then I got pulled back into SOC, but to do some of the training side of things, the SOC support ladder. So I did that for another year or so. And then some spots opened up in where? Squad 252. So I fulfilled my role that I could have went to 252 as a fireman. I ended up going there as a lieutenant, and I was there for 7.5 years. Tremendous squad company. What I love about the company more than anything is they are just all business. There's no pounding a chest. They're quiet professionals that go to fires. They're also an engine in and around Bushwick, so they catch some really good engine work, and then they're catching the whole eastern half of Brooklyn for any fire duty. And the members there do an amazing job. They're in an old 1896 firehouse, beautiful old firehouse that's immaculate. The members keep it really, really clean and make my job wonderful there. We always had top-notch firefighters working there. So I was there for 7.5 years until I got promoted to captain. And again, same thing. They pull you out of SOC, I ended up covering in a division, 11th division is where I live actually in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. It's, let's just say, the nicer half of Brooklyn. And if there is such a thing, but there it is where I live. And so I was there for 3.5 years. Again, phenomenal. I loved it. Everyone treated me really, really well, but they all kind of knew that at some point I'd make my way back to SOC. And if you you wait a little while, you know, and people knew who I am, and I think I've presented myself well through the years. So at some point, the Chiefs, you know, kind of gave me a call. Hey, John, we got some openings. Are you, you know, would you like to come back to SOC? And I of course, you would be crazy to say no. I said, absolutely. So I got back to SOC, and I was a roving captain. So you just cover all the companies. And one of my roles there, we have what is called 18R. It's a replacement officer that fills in. But the rotation is all the rescue companies. So that's all you work in from one to the next. It is by far the greatest rotation known to mankind in the fire service. And I did that for a little while, and it was phenomenal because you really get to meet everybody in the command. And each rescue is very different, and that's what's kind of cool about it too. But at one point, an opening came up in Rescue One, and I was asked to go there. And once you go there, you're there for a little while. And then the way our job works is any opening in any particular firehouse gets put out to the world. And anyone in the entire department can put in for that spot, which a bunch of people did. And I was fortunate, again, having a storied career that I have. I've been very, very lucky in my career. I was chosen. And so,
was there no tryouts or anything like that for that position? Or
the rescue, the five rescue companies, I can't speak for the squad captains, but I think it pertains to them as well. But the five rescue captains are solely chosen by the commissioner.
Oh, wow. That's high praise right there.
Yeah. So I was, again, I was given the nod, and that was January of 2020. So, oh,
wow. Great stuff. So tell us a little about the rescue company. So when I got in the fire service, I was obsessed with Rescue 2, reading anything and everything I could. And then obsessed with FDNY as a young firefighter. So tell us about the five different rescues and what they do.
So they're all trained similarly. They all do, any type of special operations you can think of: confined space, hiring a rope, trench, collapse, any of that stuff, including hazmat operations as well. We're supposed to know our meters well. We don't do any mitigation, but we're certainly going to be at the tip of the spear if there is some real bad stuff that's dispersed in the city. Or when the U-Haul truck went down the West Side Highway, taking out a whole bunch of people, a Squad 18 and Rescue 1 were both with the other first two companies, working on multiple patients at any given time. Man under training, we just had one last night. I just came off of 24 before doing this blog. We had a man under right at Grand Central. Between fire and police, we were able to get the gentleman out and off to the emergency room. So we're doing all of that. As for the difference in each rescue does something a little different. Certainly Manhattan in Rescue 1, we don't do the most amount of fires. Rescue 2, Rescue 3 do more fires than we do. But we clearly would do the most technical rescue, be it high angle or any type of construction accident, things of that nature. And then we definitely put divers in the water on a regular basis. In and around being an island. The other rescues take a little while to get to water. We have water, two blocks away on 43rd Street, right to the west side. So we put people in the water very, very, very quickly. But really our mission, the main mission of a rescue company by design, is to safeguard any firefighter on the fire ground. So we are we had a fire last night on the 31st floor at 181 East 65th Street, right off of 3rd Avenue. As we pulled up, windows were being taken on the 30th floor. Do you know what glass raining down on a rig from the 30th floor is like? It was like we were being attacked by some aircraft strafing run or something. It just caught me totally off guard, and then I realized what it was. And don't look up. That's the main thing. Put your head down and get to the building. And once you get to the building, the chances of the glass getting you are pretty next to nil, But but the fire had actually kind of burned itself out. Like the whole thing we talk about with fire science and a modern fire needing the amount of air to burn. It was a 2,800 square foot apartment on the 31st floor, huge apartment. Mm-hmm. It's for sale for $11 million. And it's unsprinklered. Think of that.
Nice.
That's crazy. It was crazy. But so fire got going, then kind of shut itself down. But when the first two companies got there and they went in, it didn't get a chance to get going again. But, the place was devastated. There was a door off the hinges. We're not quite sure if there might have been some sort of event that knocked it off, or maybe there was some warping to the framework and it just kind of fell out. We're not quite sure. But really challenging fire. And that's what you get in Manhattan. You don't get as many fires, but you get these really challenging fires. Rescue 2 goes through a tremendous amount of fires. They cover tremendous distance. I know the captain there really well. I know a bunch of the members were from Squad 252 there as well. And they, you know, I can't say enough about them. I could never say that in person to them, but I can certainly say that to the world to them. They're an incredible group of people. They really, really are. And so they go to they do an amazing job. They do a tremendous amount of fire duty. Rescue 3, again, doesn't do as much running around, but they get just insane fires up in the Bronx, especially over the last year or two. I'm not quite sure why that is, but I have some thoughts on it. But they just had a fire where there were 17 fatalities, multiple dwelling doors left open, 17 fatalities in all within. You're talking the first 5 minutes of the fire. That's how sideways this event went. People came out of their apartments like they shouldn't have, but they don't know if they're not educated to the level of what we want people to do in these buildings. It's certainly not their fault. But they have dealt with some really horrific situations. And they had a fire, like, I'm going to say less than maybe 4 years ago, there were 13 fatalities. In that same thing, open door, buildings packed with people trying to get out. Really just crazy. So that's Rescue 3. Rescue 4 covers Queens. Again, they go to a lot of fires. But again, the buildings in Queens tend to be a little smaller, private dwellings, things like that. But they cover a massive area. I mean, it's a huge borough, Queens. So they go to a lot of good stuff there. Again, Patty Burns is the captain there. Billy Murphy's the captain of Rescue 3. Wonderful guy. He was in Rescue 4 and 2, actually. But great guy. And Patty Burns is Rescue 4. And then Jimmy Murray, who we were squad 18 members together, is the captain of Rescue 5 in Staten Island. Staten Island is a whole another borough unto itself. Again, you wouldn't think about it. Tremendous amount of hills there, homes on hills, a very, very different borough than the other four boroughs. And they have their hands full out there as well. Another great company. So
how many people staff the rescue trucks?
So every tour, it's an officer and five. Oh, wow. We don't count our officers as part of the manpower. So yes, we have six people on the rig, but really we say officer and five. And sometimes I have six. If I had, depending on what my manning is and guys haven't gone on vacation or whatever, I might have six. And I usually, sometimes that member might be detailed somewhere, but I personally like to keep them in the company if I can, because if I do get a real serious technical rescue, an extra set of hands would be huge.
Oh yeah. So how many firehouses are in FDNY?
Wow. I'm going to have to know this one. So I know there's, 197 engine companies, and I think there's 143 truck companies. Some of them are double houses, some of them are single houses. So I'm going to say we are probably right around 200 and maybe 10 or 15 firehouses that I can remember. You know, and then we have 8 squad companies, a hazmat one, and 5 rescue companies.
The reason I ask is, and I've always thought this, I've never been able to talk to an actual FDNY firefighter and ask this question, but I used to work for Lexington. We had, at the time, 18, 19 firehouses. And by the time I left after 8 years, there were 3 firehouses I never stepped foot in. And there were, out of 400, 500 firefighters, there were several I never even knew of.
Yeah.
You could probably go your whole career, a long career, and still never be in every firehouse or meet anywhere near the numbers of all the firefighters.
Correct. I can go to a racket with firemen and know everybody in the room. And then I can go to another racket and not know anybody in the room.
What's a racket?
A get together. A last tour for a chief that's been on the job for 40 years. Okay. So we'll go to the firehouse and present to him. And then maybe, you know, we'll go across the street and have a few beers. That we call that a racket, you know. And so I could go to one and know everyone in the room and go to another one and not know anybody in the room. So most of the people I know, you know, obviously SOC, but like Manhattan companies and Brooklyn companies. I know some of the guys in the Bronx, but not a whole lot of them. I know some of the guys in Queens, and I don't know anybody in Staten Island other than Rescue 5. It's quite eight. But so it's a huge job. I mean, in a lot of ways, the way people like to look at our job is each borough is its own separate fire department. That's one way you could look at it. You know what I mean? Like it's that big, you know, but somehow it works.
What about when it comes to training? So it sounds like the rescue companies, from your description, they're constantly either making, you know, making runs or training? I mean, how do you maintain so much specialty training and still be able to make runs?
Yeah, what's one good thing is we don't do building inspection and we don't do hydrant inspection. So we don't do any of that, right? So really, and the reason is because they know we're dedicated. Today, I had two younger members working, new to the company. One is brand new, but he came from a squad company. So he's already got all the technical training. He just, I don't have him scuba dove training and dive training yet. He'll get that this summer. But so those two members, we went to that fire from last night. They weren't working. So we went back to the building and went through the whole fire and some of the pros and cons of what happened and looked things over and just talked about it, you know, like taking glass 30 floors up. If you have to take a window 30 floors up, you try to get a hole in it. Before you make that hole, you have to try to at least let someone down. Hey, listen, the Third Avenue, heads up. I'm taking some glass up here, right? But once you get your initial hole, all the rest of the glass, you should try to pull in, right, with your Halligan or whatever, and try to pull it into you, because you don't, you know, a fireman with a helmet is going to be okay. A civilian, that'll kill a civilian.
Yeah.
You know, now this was 5 o'clock in the morning, no big deal. That's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. There's going to be hundreds of people on that street. You can't take windows like that. So that's, again, that's a whole different mindset when you're a Manhattan firefighter. You need to know that. So we did that in the morning. We had a small fire uptown, 115th Street, but we really weren't needed. We stood fast a little while. Then we left. On the way back, we checked out that building. And then we went back to the firehouse. We had lunch. And then the afternoon was a high angle drill for those two new guys. Mm-hmm. And so that was for a couple hours. And you got to remember, on this was Monday, we go through all the ropes, including one 600-foot, you know, Cremantle rope. So that's Monday.
You go through, you take it out and visually inspect
it? Take it out and we flip it around. You check every inch of it, make sure it's good. You flip it and you repack it.
Oh, okay.
Everything else gets taken apart. All the 4-to-1s get taken. Everything gets taken apart and put back together, flipped.
Oh, yeah. So you already have like 3-to-1s, 4-to-1s already set, ready to go. You don't have to like make your mechanical advantage.
No. We have one preset, but then we have a gear bag that we can make whatever we need. We used to keep another one built just recently. My guys are always tweaking things, you know, and so it's like, yeah, having one preset, that's good for. When we do our haul system, if we're going to piggyback on or something like that. But then the second one used to be set up, and the guy said, you know what, let's keep it apart, because now instead of having to take it apart, if we're doing something different, we'll just build the second one when we need it. And I'm like, listen, I'm the officer, right? I oversee everything, but you guys are doing it. So if you're telling me that you think that's a better way to go and you get a consensus in the company, I'm all good with that.
Oh, wow.
Wow. It's that simple. So my guys are always tweaking things.
And it's got to go through all three shifts, I take it.
Yeah, well, we don't do an ABC like that. So our groups with four officers, a captain and three lieutenants and 25 members in the company. Right now, I think I'm at 24. But I'm going to take another individual shortly. You tend to work with your groups, but people are always doing mutuals. Mm-hmm. So really you work with everybody, and including the officers. I'll occasionally flip a tour with an officer and to work with those other members. So there's really not like, it's not like A, B, C, D or whatever you want to do. It's right. A much more mixed bag, which I think builds a stronger company overall.
Now you mentioned you just got off of 24, and I know you don't do 24. So you probably switched with somebody, right?
Right. Our regular setup is like 2 9-hour days, a day and a half off, 2 night tours, 15 hours, and then 3 days off and keep doing it. But whenever you're day tours, there's someone opposite you night tours.
Right.
So all you do is you pick up this one. I picked up you even forget what today is. I picked up Sunday night, Monday. That was my 24. So I went in at 1800 Sunday night. I got off at 1800 Monday night. That's my 24. And I don't go back in until I go back in Wednesday night, Thursday night.
And you were probably bored compared to the excitement of the podcast with me today. So it's like a little kid going to Disneyland. You probably couldn't sleep the night before and everything like that. I get it. I get that a lot.
I was all wound up. I took my meds. I'll be okay.
I get to talk to a Southern Indiana firefighter. Yay!
Nah, so listen, it's all good. It's all good. But no, our, you know, like we didn't. It was a slow night, other than the fire at 5 a.m.
Right.
We didn't. You know, sometimes we'll do 53X, which is an extrication car wreck. The police department calls it a 53X, so we kind of adopted that. So sometimes you'll go out of four, five, or six of them. You know, and a lot of times you never get to them because it's not a pin. Someone thinks it's a pin, but the first unit gets here and says no pin. You know, we didn't have a lot of those. It was a quiet night, which is okay. I'll take the quiet nights and you take the busy nights. You know, you don't, I can't pick and choose. We just try to, and then a lot of times we'll sometimes turn out. If we hear we had two of those, one in the afternoon, it sounded like there was a fire downtown. Turned out it was, I think that was just rubbish up against the building. But we'll turn out without being dispatched, because as a rescue company, you can do that. You know, you just kind of let dispatch, hey, we're going to take that box in, you know, and we just try to get ahead of the curve of getting down there so that if something bad happens, we're on scene, you know.
Yeah, cool. Now, what got you into the ISFSI where I met you?
That's great. Another great question. Wow, you really got these lined up questions. So who's the president?
Who's the president? Right now it would be Peter Van Dorp.
Okay, so Peter and I met in 2006 when we were investigating wind impacted fires. He was still a chief in Chicago. That's how long I know Pete.
Oh, because New York and Chicago worked together on that.
Right, exactly. So we go out to Toledo, Ohio. We blow air into a building. I didn't even know what a positive pressure fan was, but Jerry Tracy was spearheading it with Dan Majakowski and NIST.
Right.
UL's not even in the picture yet.
Okay.
They're not even involved at all. They're doing other research, you know, in their own facility up in Northbrook. So we blow air into this building and wow, look, we can pressurize these stairwells. This is pretty cool, you know? And Pete's like, listen, this is all wonderful, but if you don't do it up against fire, real fire, my Chicago guys will say, oh God, it doesn't matter to me, you know? So less than 6 months later, we're now in Chicago in the Robert Taylor houses, burning apartments, pressurizing stairwells, creating wind impacted fires. It was phenomenal. And that's where I also, and by the way, in Toledo, that's where I met Dan Majakowski and Steve Kerber. Steve was working for Dan at NIST.
Oh, I've always said that Dan Majakowski has probably saved more firefighters' lives than anybody. And he's not even a firefighter.
He is an incredible individual on so many levels. First of all, he's such a regular guy. He's an incredibly humble guy. Mm-hmm. There is so much going on in that man's brain at any given moment. It's just insanity. I mean, we've become friends through the years. But think about it from me, my perspective. In fact, the fire last night that kind of choked itself out, I'm going to call him probably tomorrow on it. I can call him at any time and say, Dan, here's what's going on. What are your thoughts? Well, you know, John, it depends. That's how he starts every answer. Every time. And then he'll go into this incredible amount of information about pertaining, like, very specific to your situation. Well, we did a little bit of research on that over here. And we did a little bit over here. We kind of put them together. It would kind of tend to say maybe this, you know. Nothing's clear cut, really. But when we're in Chicago, now we're burning, real live burning. That led directly to Governor's Island, where we're going to drop curtains, use high floor below nozzles, pressurize stairwells to see if it really works in a real building under real wind conditions. And it does.
Wow.
It does. Very well, actually.
Governor's Island really kind of set all this off. Is kind of like what pushed all this through the fire service and woke a lot of people up and like, wow, we're doing this wrong. Everything that we're doing is pretty much based in something that was just a story or a myth told by another person.
Correct.
So it's great to get that science behind it. So that's how you got into the ISFSI, is I guess PVD kind of pushed you.
Well, I didn't finish. So then when Pete asked me when they were rolling out the basement fires, when they were rolling it out, I think what was done prior to that was fire dynamics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think they saw that, you know, listen, can we get a few more instructors you know, in this mix. It'll help us deliver the message. So he asked me, he goes, listen, John, would you be interested? And I said, yeah, well, what's it all about? I knew nothing about the ISFSI, you know, so I joined and then went to the one meeting when we were putting together the basement fire class. And, you know, I met all you guys, and you guys are phenomenal, like fantastic instructors and really into it. And I'm like, oh, this is great. So I really, I don't like to travel a lot from home. I mean, I wasn't even Rescue One captain then, but now having that responsibility as a captain, you really can't be on the road all the time. And right. You know, you see me, I'm not, I don't do a lot of them. You know what I mean? I do them when I can. And I kind of tell them, listen, if you think there's a heavy lift, I did Boston a while back, you know, if I can come in with my experience in the FDNY and sell it, you know, that it makes sense, I'm willing to do that because I think the message is important. And the message we're delivering with ISFSI is directly in alignment with everything UL is doing and is in direct alignment with NFPA 1700. You know what I mean? Like, it's all in alignment. And it's not about your take on it. It's what's the data show us? What's the data show us? What does it mean? You know? Right. So, yeah.
You know what's funny, though, and I've said this to a few of my guests, people like you and me that have been in over 25 years, right? I think we may have earned that old head, you know, moniker, but it's also people. What surprises me all the time, myself included, is that people like us are usually the ones that are settled into their ways and they're just kind of biding their time. But when I see you, you're very progressive. You're part of the studies. You're part of the panels. You're part of you're out there in the cadre teaching it. So that's always, to me, one of my favorite things to see is somebody that has been in the fire service for a while, but they're not settled in. They haven't just said, you know, this is exactly how fire is. It's never a finish line. It's always a race. And I noticed that with you right away.
So I did a firehouse keynote for Timmy Sendelback a number of years ago when Timmy was involved. And what I was trying to get across in that was I am any naysayers in the room. I am you. You know, I came into the fire service with rubber boots, 3/4 boots. I didn't ride the back, you know, the tailboard of an FDNY rig, but I did ride the tailboard in Roslyn Highlands on the back of a 1970 Sutphin pumper that had a V12 Detroit 2-stroke 5-speed, you know, doing 80 miles an hour. Like it was an amazing truck. It sounded like a tugboat going down a road, but I was part of that, you know. And so when I went into the FDNY, we weren't wearing hoods. We were wearing leather helmets. I did all that. And I would have never flowed water in a window. My first captain, Patty Corcoran, would have killed you if you ever thought of doing that. Patty wasn't wrong. It's what he saw, you know, his war years showed him, this is how we fight fires. We get inside and we put this fire out. And that's not wrong. And that still applies today. However, we thought, right, you said it before, what we think happens and what really happens, it's important to know what's really happening. Yes. So now I was told you're going to kill everybody in there if you throw water in a window. Okay, that's senior guy just told me that. I'm not doing that.
Right.
And then when we saw I'll tell you, this is where that actually we learned this. So we're at Governor's Island. We're testing 7 different high-rise nozzles, all different configurations, right? One's hooked on the windowsill, one just laid on the sill. And the first time we're going to flow water into a fully involved apartment, I'm like, this is going to be great. We're going to see a fireball in the hallway. This is going to be awesome, you know? And we flowed the water, and the fire went out. Well, what was that, you know? Do it again, you know? So and we set everything back up. We got another room. It's going good. All right, let it have it, you know? Where'd the fire go? Out. Oh, let's get a fog nozzle on there. That'll do it, you know? Hey, out. Every time. I think we did like 13 experiments. Every time the fire went out in the bedroom, in the apartment, and in the hallway, it went out. Yeah. Temperatures nosedove. They didn't go up. It didn't kill everybody. So we're like, holy Jesus, now what do we do? You know? So then that led to when we did Governor's Island, we specifically tried to whip the nozzle around and push fire every which way we could. We could not do it. Now, that doesn't, what we've come to learn since then is it's not the line. It's It's not the water pushing the fire. It's what we're doing with the water.
Right, right. The air treatment.
Right, that's what we learned. Now, I still believe when the statement, water does not push fire, the hand line does not push fire, I still believe that. It's what you do with the hand line that you could potentially, if circumstances are just right, you could maybe move some products of combustion to a place you don't want it to go, okay? Right. But if you do it right, it's not happening. And now let's look at the benefits. And the only way to look at the benefits is with data. And that's where it all pieces together, right? Yep. And that's what we're doing. So it's just follow the science, follow the data, and then, and then make an intelligent decision.
Right, so, right. And if you ever have to deviate from the data, be informed why you're doing that. I mean, just doing it to do it is one thing. But if you actually do something differently based on your experience in the moment, right, and it's informed, knowing the data, that to me, I understand that. But right, just doing the same thing every time just because that's the way we've always done it, that's just stupid. That's just basing your success on lack of failure is all it is.
I can tell you, right, truly, I believe this. The one department that really should not how can I say this? The department that should not use that information the wrong way is my department. And I'll tell you why. In my department, I can throw engine company after engine company after engine company at a fire until it goes out. It's either going to burn itself out or we eventually make it down a hallway, whatever happens first, right? I can send people to the burn center all day long and not run out of firemen, okay? When you're in other parts of the country, and that's what, like, the value of us teaching around the country, and that, like in LA County, some of those, I got three people on the engine. What do you got three people? Yeah, I got a chauffeur, an officer, and one in the back. That's it. Mm-hmm. And guess what? So now let's take that data and say, what's the best thing for me to do on this fire right now when I only have three people? Because if I go interior and they can't make the push or they get burned, you're done.
Yep.
So how about let's take some teeth out of it, 10 seconds of water in the window before we go in. Makes all the sense in the world. So that's why I think my department has to be, take a step back in this and just say, we're not the ones that should be saying, don't do this. We should be the ones that embrace it and use it when we should, because mm-hmm. we're going to get away with not using it, right? Other places will not get away with not using it.
No, you definitely have plenty of people, like you said, yeah. And fairly close. Somebody like me, we have three on our engines. We have four on our ladders. So, and that's still understaffed if you ask me, but yeah, that's an excellent point. I never even thought about it like that.
Yeah. So, and I love what Pete Van Dorf says about it is if you now know the data, you know the information and you're actively choosing not to use it, there's a little liability there.
Exactly.
And I'm not talking about lawyers and going to court or anything. Personal liability.
Yeah.
If you don't use that tactic and you lose people or something bad happens, the fire gets away from you and there's a collapse and then a fireman gets hurt. And when you first got there, you could have used that. That's real bad.
Yep.
So
it's ego. Usually ego.
100%. 100%. And I'll say this, though. If you really think you got a crackerjack engine and there'll be no delay getting in there and getting water on that fire, okay. That's a decision you're going to make in that moment. But what happens when you're in Roslyn Highlands, my hometown, and you got two 18-year-olds and my uncle's driving a rig at 75, and I got two – that's the one that I don't know if they can get into that quick and do this. Not their fault. They've never done it before. Let's hit it from the outside. Let's calm this thing down. Then we're going to go inside and finish it off.
Absolutely.
So there's all those decisions.
Yes. Now, you mentioned something earlier about riding tailboard. Yeah. I was fortunate enough to ride tailboard early in my career. And I think firefighters that have never done it romanticize it. Me personally, it has to be a really nice day to enjoy riding on a tailboard.
The winter sucked.
Yes. If it's raining, it sucks. You're up under a tarp. If it's these firefighters always talking about, these younger firefighters, I'd love to ride tailboard. No, you wouldn't. You really, I mean, if it's a nice 80 degree day, it's a blast. But you have way more shittier days on the tailboard than you'll ever have. A nice
right. And we had a mini pumper. 591 was a little mini pumper. And when you were standing in a tailboard, there was nothing protecting you. There was no screen or nothing, right? And on more than one occasion, if you hit bumps wrong, you ended up in the hose bed.
Yes. Yeah, that's so another thing. If you had a shitty driver, you hated riding tailboard.
Right, because he was supposed to be cognizant of people back there. So, like, you know, you got to take turns a little differently, like, you know, calm it down a little bit.
Absolutely.
It was fun.
Yeah, I think of the nice days in Texas. It was a blast, but I just, man, middle of the night, cold, rainy. There's nothing snow pleasant storms. About it. Nothing.
Yeah, we get snowstorms up in Illinois.
Oh, yeah. Oof, fuck all that. So let me pick your brain a little bit about 9/11. Can you tell me I've heard the story before. You've told me when we were in LA, and I thought it was an amazing story. Do you have any trouble telling me that today?
No. It's it's the facts of what happened. You know, and believe me, there were thousands and thousands of those stories. Any given racket, as I spoke before, I might be talking to somebody, and some of my friends, like, I didn't even know where they were, you know, and then all of a sudden they'll say, yeah, I was like underneath the pumper, you know, I couldn't breathe. And I'm like, really? Where were you? I probably walked right past you. I didn't even know it. You know, like real weird stuff like that happened all the time. There's one just happened to me recently. I'll have to recall it. But this individual I was talking to, we probably passed each other at one point because he was describing things exactly as I remembered them. At the same exact time, like in between the collapses. So where would you like me to start?
Well, I believe you started last time by telling me you rode your bike across the Brooklyn Bridge when it happened.
Yeah.
So what did you think when the first plane hit, and you heard about it, what did you think was happening? Was it just a fluke think it was an attack?
Yeah, I thought not. It was an accident, like I think most people did. So I was living in Brooklyn, right on the other side of the Brooklyn Bridge, not far from the base of the Brooklyn side of the Brooklyn Bridge in an area called Carroll Gardens, beautiful little area of Brooklyn. There are beautiful areas of Brooklyn, by the way. And hopefully you'll see that when you're here in New York. But I was not working, and my wife had gone to put her on the subway. I was having a cup of coffee, and I see the news, and I see one tower's hit, and I'm like, is that like a reenactment of a disaster? Like, what is that? You know? And then the phone rings and my mother-in-law calls and she said, what's going on in New York? And I said, I don't know, mom, but I got to go to work. Click. And I knew in my head, I know how Manhattan traffic is. I'm like, it's going to be a nightmare in lower Manhattan. It's 17 minutes on my bicycle when I ride pretty quick. So I jumped on my mountain bike and went over to Brooklyn Bridge. And when I was on the middle of the bridge, I felt a massive concussion. And I looked to my left and there was a huge fireball. That was the second plane hitting. I didn't know it was a plane though. I thought something let go inside the building, you know? So now you had two buildings on fire. So I'm like, oh man, this is going to be some humdinger of a fire. You know, people are going to be trapped above. This is going to be a nightmare. However, I'm probably not going to get up into that building for hours from now. I just know in my head of how a high rise fire works. I'm off duty. I got to go to the firehouse, get my gear. I got to get down to the site. I mean, I know all that, those logistics. It's going to be quite a long time if ever I go, you know. So anyway, when I got to the firehouse, well, as I got into Manhattan, people are yelling, go the other way, you know, get out of Manhattan. So I zigzag through them and I get to another firehouse, 20 truck, which is on Lafayette Street in Spring. And the reason I went there is Squad 18 was stationed there while they were renovating our firehouse. They were redoing the cement floors in the firehouse. So that's where they are. When I got there, Howie Scott, another member of Squad 18, was waiting. And he said, listen, John, it's a terrorist attack. The fire marshals have a car waiting for us. Get your gear. Let's get in here and let's get down there, 10-4. So I got my gear, grabbed a bottle of water, remember, and we jumped in the car. And they zipped us right down to the site, lights and sirens. So we were down there very early. Both towers are still standing. And this is where I think my guardian angel, my whatever was on my shoulder. I followed what a firefighter should do, right? We don't go off on our own. We don't do our own thing, right? I had all my gear with me, and I checked in with the command post. And at the command post was Chief Ray Downey. And he just said, John, just the next SOC units that come in, hook up with them and go to work, 10-4. So with that, Rescue 4 and Squad 288 came up. I attached myself to them. We went and staged in a building adjacent to the Twin Towers or the site. And that's where we were. We witnessed the falling debris, which turned into be falling human beings. And it was just, I can't even, you were looking at it like, what is that? And then you realize what it was. And that was very, very sobering moment. So everybody was very quiet, but everyone was determined. Nobody was freaking out or anything. The officers were kind of chatting. And then I realized I don't have a mask. I don't have an air cylinder or anything. So I go to Lieutenant Kerwin from 288. And I said, listen, I don't have a mask. So he goes, okay, you and Howie, go find equipment, go find masks. And if we're not here, we'll be in the South Tower lobby. And 10-4, so off we went. Now, the masks were very hard to find. Most companies rode down there with more than 6 people. So all their extra gear was gone. They probably grabbed stuff in the firehouse, whatever they could find. Checking the rigs. I turned at one point, and I could see Rescue 4 and 288 had left the American Express building, walked across West Street in a single file, and they were heading what I believe to be into the hotel, which was attached to the South Tower. So I knew where they were. So I didn't have to go back to that building. I knew where they'd be. We get to Hazmat 1, which was parked at Vesey and West. And I knew that the member, Hazmat always leaves one member back to look things up, call Chemtrex or whatever they're going to do back there. Mm-hmm. It's the resource guy, Tony Castagna. And I look at him, hey, Tony, you got masks? And he goes, yep. And it was the mask for the Level A suits they kept underneath. So we pulled them out, put them on. And just as we're about to step off, he says, hey, you want hour bottles as opposed to half hour cylinders? We didn't go to 45s yet. So we had half hour cylinders. And I'm like, oh, it's a high rise fire. You know what? Instead of carrying an extra cylinder, I'll just put the hour bottle on my back. So we took a minute, 2 minutes. We switched out the bottles, Howie and I. We had 2 other firefighters with us, and then off we walked. Now we're walking south on West Street. And if you remember, from the North Tower over to the Winter Garden, there was this enclosed walking sidewalk, like an elevated sidewalk enclosed. And we got underneath that. And Rescue 1's rig was right there. I never remember even seeing Rescue 1's rig, but it was right there. We get under the north walkway, and Howie's looking up, and I'm looking forward, and he just goes, oh, shit. And with that, I look up, and you saw the South Tower, the whole top of the tower, if you remember the videos at all, about a 30 or 40-foot section from the injury to the top of the building, just sat down one flight, one level, bam. And once that energy started moving down, it just continued. Bah, 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 bah. I didn't need to look anymore. I didn't know what was going on, but time to run. You know how they always say, never run on the fire ground? Mm. When a building's collapsing, you're allowed to run. All right. So so we ran north, Howie and I, and there was a white van. I got behind a white van. I shouldered the back of the van, and I just said, well, let's see what's happening, because my brain doesn't understand that concept, And then I swear to you, it went pitch black, not gray, it was black, and not even just black. It was like the cloud was so dense with product, with dust and whatnot. You felt it like all over your body as it moved past you. I had no Rolodex of information to make sense of this, right?
Right.
My prime recognition decision-making, right? Like, there was nothing for me to go back to. So what do you do as a fireman? I tried to breathe. I couldn't. I couldn't breathe because it was so dense. Okay. Well, I remember I knelt down. I put my helmet between my legs, just like a man on a fire, zero visibility. I reached around, turned my cylinder on, shook my mask out, but I really couldn't shake it out. I thought I was shaking it out. Put it to my face, and I took a breath. And I got whatever was in the mask. I ingested that, but then I could breathe. So I'm like, okay, I'm alive. I'm not dead, So I put everything on, and I started to walk north. Again, zero visibility. If it's zero visibility, should I have been walking? course not. So I tripped over something that fell down. I went, oh, Jesus, what's that? So now I start crawling. And I think I'm crawling north towards Chambers Street, where I know, you know, at least something might be up there. And when the dust settled enough to see, which I'm not, I don't know if it was a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, I have no idea, who's standing in the middle of the road but Ray Downey, my chief of special ops. So I took my mask and everything off, and I went up to him. Hey, chief. He said, John, get everybody, and let's get north. We're going to reform up at Chambers Street. We'll reform the command post, 10-4K. With that, Commissioner Feehan, who was still alive, grabs me, and he says, listen, 18. He didn't know who I was. He goes, 18. He goes, we got a fireman giving a mayday at Liberty and West. Go get him. 10-4, right? When a former chief of the department commissioner gives you an order, you follow your orders, right?
Sure,
so sure. Off I went. And he goes, and take this probie with you. Now I got a probationary firefighter with me, the last thing I wanted in the world, you know?
Now, what about Howie? Whatever happened to Howie after?
Well, that's a good question. So, you know, in Backdraft, you know, you go, we go. You know that one?
Right. Yeah. Howie left you.
Howie actually, I ran back into him at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, almost, a half a day later is when I finally found Howie. I thought he was killed. I had no idea. I got behind the white van. He kept running north. And he said when the cloud got to him, there was so much momentum to the cloud, it tumbleweeded him. It flipped him end over end and pushed him north. But he survived. Yeah. So now I got this other kid. We go south. And I remember saying to the kid, I go, listen, that tower was injured like that tower. That one collapsed. That one's going to collapse. We just don't know when. Keep your eyes on it, you know. And so we made our way south. There was a woman with a broken leg who eventually I found out a friend of mine got her out of there. And then I had a mission. We're looking for a firefighter. So I get down to where the south walkway is, and there's just firemen walking around all dazed and confused. Like, anybody see? Is there a down fireman? Is there a pass along? Anything. So we start kind of climbing up onto the rubble of the hotel, looking in nooks and crannies and whatnot. And then I hear the kid who was with me, his kid Latimer, I hear, John, John. He's like screaming. And I remember, and they talk about when we do a class called the Mental Performance Initiative, they say time either speeds up or slows down. And I remember turning and looking at this kid, and he was running now west towards the North Cove. And he was in slow motion as he was running. Like, it was the weirdest thing in the world. I remember it like vividly. And so then in the background, now I start hearing this boom, boom, boom. Conversely, the first collapse, I heard nothing. But I think either I was scared shitless or the dust cloud blocked the sound. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I guess. But now I hear this clear as day, and I jump off the pile, and I ran underneath the walkway, and there were ambulances lined up, and there were doors to the back of one was open. I jumped into the back of one, and as that happened, the sound just got louder and louder, and then a gust of wind came and blew the doors of the van, of the back of the ambulance shut. So now I'm in the back of the ambulance by myself, not understanding what's going on. And it got so loud, I remember cupping my ears, and then it stopped, and then the whole earth shook. Like, everything shook, and that was everything settling down, you know.
Now, so how close was the ambulance to the second tower going down?
When you're in New York, you'll see. I would probably estimate maybe 300 yards, maybe.
You know? Oh, wow.
Yeah. Maybe not even that. I bet it's not far, but just as how the towers came down, you know, it's a certain way that it didn't kind of lay down that way. So I waited a couple minutes again, not sure what the time frame was, and then at some point, I remember opening up the back door and like looking out, and everything's on fire. Fire trucks are flipped over on their side. They're on fire. The buildings are on fire. I mean, it was just like, I'm like, what? I shut the door. I remember shut the door going, holy Jesus, you know? So, but I just did it a half an hour ago. So I masked up and put everything back on. I still had air in my cylinder. I didn't ditch my cylinder. I kept it. And now I step out. I'm alone. There's no one there. There's no other fireman. There's nothing. Just white dust, rigs, buildings on fire. You know, just crazy. So then I walk towards the walkway. Now I start seeing people, you know, and I ran into a rescue three guy, Dave Drury. And I said, "Davey, man, what are you doing?" He goes, "Holy Jesus, you know, cell phones weren't working. Pay phones weren't working." I made my way into the Winter Garden Hotel. Really strange event there. As we were walking across where the palm trees are, a piece of steel had come through the seal, through the atrium and nailed a guy. I believe either he got blown out of the building or he got hit with the steel in there. And I reached in, he was dead. But I got to a phone and was able to call my girlfriend and just say, it was my wife now, and just say, "I'm alive. I don't know when I'm coming home, but I'm alive. I should just call my family, tell them I'm alive. That's it. And I'll see you when I see you." And that was it. The rest of that day, well into the night, was just these futile efforts of looking for survivors, you know. And it took a couple days, but I think by that Friday, I remember coming home and kind of breaking down, just said to my wife, just saying, "They're all dead. Like, we're not going to find anybody," you know, and that's for firefighters. That's, you know, we thought we were going to have hundreds, if not thousands of people trapped in voids and this, that, you know, they were all dead. It was really just a crazy, I wasn't involved in getting Jay Jonas out of the tower, the North Tower stairwell. I didn't have a radio, so I didn't hear any of that action going on. They did a great job getting him out. And there was, I think there was one other guy. Oh, I know what I was going to tell you was, the guy I was sent by Feehan to look for, I met his sons.
Really? Whatever happened to that?
So it was a chauffeur of, I'm going to say maybe 22 engine. It was a chauffeur of one of the engines. And he was given a mayday. He was trapped and given a mayday. And they eventually did get to him and got him out of there. That was the guy I was going to get look for. Yeah. So he did get out, which is great. You know, so that's it. So then, you know, we spent days and days. The one odd thing with Squad 18 was we found all our people. They were in the North Tower stairwell, all crushed, obviously. They were with some members of Rescue One. They were heading up, you know, they were doing their job.
If you didn't have to find a mask, you would have been there with them.
Most likely. I would have certainly been in a worse position. Then all of Rescue 4 got killed. All of 288 got killed. Ray Downey got killed. Commissioner Feehan got killed. Pretty much everybody I was with prior to either tower coming down got killed. That's so really pretty much how it happened.
Ray Downey and them, they died when the second tower came down, right?
Correct.
So they were trying to move the command post.
What's that?
They were trying to move the command post. They knew after the first tower, and then the second one, as they were trying to move it.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So they sent me south. So Commissioner Feehan, when I got to one of the memorials for Pete and Tommy Langone, they were two brothers. Pete was in the fire department. Tommy was a cop. I grew up with both of them in Roslyn. When they did their memorial service, I pulled Commissioner Feehan's son aside, John Feehan, who I know very well. And I told him the story. And like, how do you tell a son, you know, to your father's last breath, he was a chief doing his job. It was incredible. And he saved my life.
And to your point earlier, he had no Rolodex either. He didn't have recognized prime decision-making. And for him to be able to be that cognizant to direct everybody, not just, you know, like you working with your crew, he had to direct everybody and everything. That's amazing.
Amazing. Amazing man. Great guy. Yeah. It just really sad. You know, our department took many years to even recoup all that law got lost that day. We did, but it took a long time.
I was going to say, how do you even start the next day? I mean, how do you even?
You know what's really amazing is, you know, we never had companies out of service. I think, you know, maybe day one we did, but in short order, our shops got all the spare rigs up and running and had companies operating in the city, you know, like it wasn't like companies were just shut down and not functioning ever again. No, they figured it out. And I will say, like, when it comes to that large scale operation, we understood incident command as a department. We just didn't understand magnitude of this thing and how to handle it. And that's where, again, kind of like, you know, what we're doing with ISFSI, going around the country and teaching all over the place, people from outside our department, definitely the FEMA USAR teams, they were very respectful of our space, but were coercing us. Listen, there's a way to manage this. There's a way this can be done. Ah, we got it. We got it. You know, we got it. But really, just listen, take a moment and listen to what I have to say. And I think by like day three, our chiefs were like, okay, we see your point. And then we relinquished, I wouldn't say we relinquished control, but we allowed them to come in and say, hey, this is how you do it. You know, your sectors, you're this, you're that, you know. And I think in short order, we saw that, no, we needed that help. You know, the practice of running a large wildland fire was of great value that day and the coming weeks and months that were going to be presented to us. How to get your ducks in a row on a grand scale. And to learn it yourself, it's going to, you know, you'd have to go to 10 911s. You don't want to do that. So you bring these people in and know it. And then from that grew our IMT team, our incident management team. And our incident management team now, you know, again, as a proud New Yorker, I'll say this, a proud FDNY, probably one of the best in the country, because they've learned big time how to do it. And then they now travel, you know, out west to manage wildland fires, you know, for the members out there. And then they bring that back, you know, another level of that back to our job. So we're very good at all that now. We weren't necessarily then. So
how long was it till you got to go home? I mean, after that, I mean, did you stay there?
I left around that. I remember I was there. Let's see. So it was Tuesday morning. Wednesday morning around 6 a.m. I couldn't see anymore. I literally couldn't see anymore. And what happened was shards of fiberglass had gotten into my eyes and lodged in my eyelids. And every time I blinked my eyes, it was scratching my corneas. So yeah. I went back to, I walked back at like, I remember that, I think it was like 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. I walked back to 20 truck. I tried to clean my eyes out numerous times there. I had water flowing in them. It just wasn't doing it. And I then walked from 20 truck up to 14th Street. You gotta remember, there was like the streets are barren, like, you know, everybody's in shock. I walked up to 14th Street. There's an eye and ear hospital there. And they took me in and they did some stuff to my eyes, but they really didn't, it wasn't good. I remember going back to 20 truck and then saying, I just can't see. I went back, I walked back up to 14th Street, which is a pretty good walk. But there was, you know, nothing else available. No taxis, there was no way to get around. Subways were shut down. So then there they put some drops in my eyes, and this one, I remember this Asian, female Asian doctor rolled my eyelid up, and then she could see by the scratches in my cornea where the fiberglass shards were. Mm-hmm. And then she started plucking them out, and I immediately got relief. I was like, oh God, thank God. And then once that happened, I think I went home briefly, and then the next day back to back to ground zero. And then you were just there for, you know, days. And then you take a break and then be back for days. But then you had to work in the firehouse too. We had to man the company. So was all part of that.
I know a lot of people I worked with were like, we're getting a bunch of people together. We're going to drive up to New York and help them. All those people coming to help, how was that even? I mean, was there a way for these people to check in, or did you just be working right next to a firefighter doing the best they can?
Those first couple of days, there was no, that's what I mean by like, until we really got a handle on what needed to be done, it was a free-for-all, you know. But that's not necessarily a bad thing, because you had all these people volunteering and coming to help us. You know, how do you say no to that? You know, and we needed the help. You know, even a bucket brigade, I mean, you think a bucket brigade's nonsense. Well, it might be, but if there's one person trapped, all we need to move is this amount of stuff right now. We'll get the end loaders and whatnot, you know, once moving the big stuff and the cranes and all came in. But right now, we just need buckets to get this debris away from this individual. But again, we didn't find that many, so that didn't happen. But no, everybody was embraced in a good way. I don't think there was any nonsense like that going on. We knew we were overwhelmed, and we needed the help. So we thanked everyone. That's kind of, you know, right now what's going on in the Ukraine. I'm trying to get together some equipment and bunker gear and everything to go over there. We have it lined up. We have it ready to go, but we're having a little trouble with City Hall releasing equipment. Like, there's a process, you know. Hopefully tomorrow I can get some headway on it. But I feel, you know, everyone helped us on 911. So now this is a way to reciprocate. You know, when there is a problem somewhere, we should do, even if it's a small effort, it's you know, it matters. You know, we used to get, you know, we were getting, I still have it actually. We were getting hats knitted by little old ladies in Missouri, you know, and I still have one. I kept one. Actually, it's a scarf. No, it's a scarf. And I keep the scarf. It was great. Like, the people were just doing all these things for us. That was just really incredible. So I've never forgotten that.
That's great. Well, you know, I can't. You talk about not having a Rolodex. I can't even imagine what it'd be like to be a firefighter that day or the following days at something that you just, your brain is struggling to comprehend. It just, I can't even imagine. Can't even fathom.
Well, neither could I. Let's hope I never have to access those little Rolodex anymore, right? Yes. So that nothing happens. But I will say, to go back to what we were talking about earlier, one of the interesting things about my evolution as a firefighter was when I worked in Brooklyn, I had a certain mindset. After working in Manhattan at Squad 18 and then in Rescue 1, not to say there's not an emergency that can humble you, because I think that your next emergency could be that one. And I'm not saying that I know everything, because I don't know everything, far from it. But I would say that my ability to handle a complex issue was enhanced by working in Manhattan. Because we get fires where, like that fire last night, I don't see any smoke, I don't see any fire, but I'm getting hit with glass.
Right.
You know, so like, okay, let's get in this building. Let's, you know, check in the lobby command post. Let's see where the elevators are at. You know, where's our standpipe? Let's get up there. Let's get off two floors below the fire. Let's see what we got. You know what I mean? It's a process, you know. Right. Or maybe you have a fire where, you know, there's a subway entrance and there's subway tracks right underneath the building. So we have to be concerned about, you know, those issues or whatever. So, I just think for me, it made me be able to handle or juggle a couple balls at once better than when I wasn't in Manhattan. That's me.
Let me ask you one more question about 9/11. When did you realize there were other attacks outside of New York City? Was it that day or was it days?
So, like I said, Howie told me it's a terrorist attack, right? That was one thing, you know? And then at one point, I remember, you know, someone mentioning that the Pentagon was attacked as well, you know, and like, oh, Jesus. And then the real sobering moment is when, you know, F-18s are doing low passes over Lower Manhattan. That just blew me away. Like, you were like, holy cow, we are in war. Like, that was the feeling. And they, you know, they were just buzzing, up the Hudson River and really low altitude flights. So that was really very, very, very sobering. Yeah, at that point. It's really hard to believe that, you know, those son of a bitches were able to fly those planes at all and hit the buildings.
Right.
It's incredible. Especially the second one's like on a bank. Amazing. Amazing stuff. Yep. Sadly amazing. You
know? Yes, it was, I've always heard that, you know, people equate it to the loss of firefighters and cops, you know, the 343, but it was also one of the greatest rescues ever.
No doubt. So, you know, like, let's say it would have happened today. You may not lose 343, but if there's people in the building and they will collapse, you're going to lose 100 or so.
Yeah.
Because the men were doing, the people were doing their job. You know, like, I know Jay Jonas is the perfect example. He survived in that stairwell, but the only reason he didn't was there was because they were going to they weren't going to abandon that woman. They were going to get that woman down and out. And that's what put them right in that zone. Otherwise, they would have been probably out of the building more and been killed. I know plenty of guys. I know, what's the story with with the his name will come to me. Captain of Ladder
Patty
3.
Brown.
Patty Brown basically said, I will not comply with that order. Now, he's a guy that would never disobey a direct order. I order you, maybe, you know, to get out of the building now. I will not comply with that order. We're heading up. We got people upstairs. He knew it was going to, I don't think he thought it was going to collapse, but he knew something really bad was happening, but they had a job to do. And firemen do that. You know, that's we're not going to drop people and take off. I mean, maybe some people did, but the vast majority of us would not.
Yeah.
And here's the other thing too. And there were civilians who did amazing things that day. And that gets lost in the shuffle as well. You know, this is our job. This is what we train to do, you know. Right. What about the person that initiates without the training? That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Wasn't it like the largest maritime rescue effort ever?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Across the Hudson, absolutely. Every boat, every ferry was just nosing up, taking people and going to Jersey.
And they didn't have any kind of real communication, but at the same time, they coordinated their effort. You're right. There's a lot of things get lost in the shuffle, but it was actually as horrible a day as it is, and as sad as it is, we lost the brothers and sisters that we did. There were some true heroes, like you said, that weren't trained to do the job that firemen do, and they stepped up and they did the job.
And which also leads me to be so sad at how fractured our country is right now. You know.
Oh, I know. Yep.
We're so tight. We were so tight right after that for quite a long time.
So I remember when I was working part-time several days after 9/11 happened, I was in a nursing home and I was picking people up, taking them to dialysis, whatever it was for my part-time job. And there was this a lady there and she was one of the first Rockettes and she was in her 80s or whatever. And I thought that was really cool. So I enjoyed talking to her. But she had flags and everything you can imagine up there. And I said, hey, you're showing your patriotism and all that. And she goes, oh, yeah. She goes, this has only happened one other time in my life, and that was Pearl Harbor. When we were attacked then, everybody was showing patriotism. And then she said, but I really don't know how long the patriotism is going to last. And looking back on it now, knowing what we know, she wasn't wrong. You know, look at us today, all divided and over some of the silliest things.
Yeah. You know, and the sobering events that are going on in the Ukraine right now. What can you say? There's a democratic sovereign nation that is being attacked. Which and I never thought in my lifetime we would ever be dealing with the Soviet Union again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Pulling our act. I did not dream. Yeah, he did some bad things. Taking Chechnya is one thing. And I know we're getting off track now, but I never dreamed of that. But, you know, listen, maybe this is a moment that will bring us back together as a nation because we need that. You know,
sad that it would be a war that would unite us.
Right. Yeah. I mean, listen, look, in the fire service, there's you know, a bit of a war, you know, exterior stream versus, you know, aggressive interior. Okay, you know, whatever. Leather helmets versus whatever. but we can talk about it and still be friends, you know, and talk about the tactics and not get mad at each other. And you know, that's where, again, with the fire service, that's where we need to be. On one of my classes that I teach, I use Walt Whitman was a writer and poet from Long Island. So that's
he has one of my favorite quotes. Yeah.
Which is?
It is be curious, not judgmental.
Bingo. That's exactly the one I'm thinking of. And I use
Really?
And I have a slide that I put up and it just has him and it says exactly that. And that's why. So, you know, why do Europeans do things the way they do? Be curious.
Yeah.
Tell me what you got. Tell me about gas cooling. Right. Right. Okay. Great. Use PPV. Great. Tell me more about it. And don't be judgmental. If it works for them there, great. Yep. It works for them there, you know, and what we do in New York, I think we're very good at a lot of things and not so good at some other things. That's all.
Wow. That's such a kind of an obscure quote. I'm kind of surprised as someone you're thinking of. Yeah, but it's great for the fire service. I don't know if you remember, though, years ago, one of the cell phone companies had commercials about if firefighters ran the country, and it showed, you know what I'm talking about? They were all in Congress. They were Congress, and they were passing bills left and right.
Right, right. Yes, I do remember that. Yeah, yeah.
See, the fire service can be an example. We can not get along. We can argue religion, politics all day long. But when the tones drop, we're one group. We're not. Exactly. It's not even in your head not to help somebody.
I mean, you know, as a captain of Rescue One, one of my goals is you don't have to be best friends with everyone in the firehouse. That's impossible. There's too many different personalities and everything. But you have to respect each other. And you got to, you know, I'll take this from my daughter's grammar school, you know, not put downs, put ups, you know, lift the people around you. Now, listen, when you're in the kitchen, you want to break balls and you want to have some fun. No, that's the best. I mean, some and, you know, as a captain, I just got to like drink my coffee and kind of smirk to myself. I really can't. Oh, that was a good one. You know, I just kind of stay out of it. You know what I mean? And I don't drop any grenades. It's not my role anymore. You know what I mean? Yeah. But I love listening to the guys go after each other. They just hammer the hell out of each other. But again, part of that is what brings a firehouse together. You know, you can make fun of each other and not take it personal.
Right.
You know, and, you know, but I think you also have to be a little respectful of certain lines. And most of my guys are. But, you know, the most, you know, a sign of a true intelligence is humor, you know, creative humor. Not hurtful humor, you know.
And you almost had me with humor. I thought, oh, great, now I'm intelligent. Then you said hurtful humor. I'm like, no, I'm back to being a dick.
right. And a lot of times that's funny. But it's still, when you're friends, you can do it. You know, you can't be enemies. But anyway, so that's part of my role, because when you build that unit, now when they're in the shit, they're going to function together because they have a connection. And sometimes it's almost like intuitive between people. Right. You know, when guys really have worked together for a while and they really get to know each other outside the job as well as inside the job. Now it comes a little intuitive about what they're going to do. And at a fire, as a technical rescue, to me, yeah, it, depending if some real challenging stuff up on top of a high rise or anything, right? But most of it is, hey, what's the plan, you know? And we all kind of huddle up, you know, okay, but, you know, each guy has a role. One guy's a rigger. One guy, if we're putting somebody over the side, that's the can man. He's, you know, he knows what he's got to do and everything. Who's has the harnesses on and everything. I just kind of oversee anything. I said, what's the plan? And they'll say, yeah, Cap, we're going to do this, 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 and this. Sounds good to me. How about it? Go. You know, and then I'll like, you know, coordinate with the chief what we're doing and whatnot. But when you get that group together, now they start, it's just intuitive things happen. They just work.
They develop their own little shorthand on how to do that. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. So it's, you know, it's brilliant. I'm working with some really exceptional individuals. I really am. So I'm very fortunate.
Well, brother, I really cannot tell you how much I've appreciated your time tonight. I've been looking forward to this since we talked together. I wasn't sure I was going to ask you. I was a little bit fanboying. I'm not going to lie. I was fanboying a little bit. But you're the most approachable, most easygoing person.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for being on the podcast. And I cannot wait to work with you again here in a couple weeks. But you got home field advantage this time, don't you?
Yeah. Well, you know, what people have to realize with New York City is, yeah, it can be a very intimidating place, but it's really a very blue collar town. Mm-hmm. It's just big, you know. But I mean, we have great pubs all over the place. Great place to eat, great stuff to see. So we'll be seeing a little bit of it here and there. We'll definitely have you out and about. It's going to be an interesting basement fires class for the FDNY. I think some of the stuff that we do, they haven't seen yet, right. Like the alcohol prop and the air entrainment water mapping prop. They haven't seen that, you know. So it's going to be interesting when we do our little high school laboratory experiments. That's going to We should have a lot of fun with that because, you know, it's kind of goofy. But, you know, when you really look at what we're trying to show on each evolution, we're just trying to, you know, if we're firefighters, there's nothing we should not know about fire.
Exactly. We should be professionals. We should be
right.
Top level. And, yeah.
And I realized that I was not, you know, when I first started learning about stuff. And here's actually how it went down. So I'm in Toledo, Ohio, just met Dan Metzgals. We went to dinner and we're having a couple beers or whatever. Dan loves his beer. And he starts talking about all this heat release rate and megawatts. And, you know, I'm not sure if we were using flow path back then, but just talking about all this stuff, you know. And I'm like, how do I not know any of this? And he goes, well, I teach you already. I teach the FDNY. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You teach the FDNY. He would go every new fire marshal's class. He would teach the new recruits for the fire marshals about fire dynamics in relation to fire investigation.
Oh.
Didn't even know it. So George Healy, who was my good friend and deputy chief now in the 13th Division, at the time he was not. We're together, and we're like, when are you coming to New York next? Oh, I'll be there 2 months. George and I sat in a class with the fire marshals, and it was fire dynamics. And I'm like, every firefighter needs to know this, not just the marshal.
Yep.
But that's who was getting that education, not everyone else. That was like 06, 07. You know, so he had already been doing it.
Well, that's the thing that sets the whole tone for the class that we teach together is if you understand firefighter dynamics and flow path, air entrainment, it is an easy jump straight into how you attack a basement fire if it's limited access, no access, or a walkout. It's such an easy transition. You don't have that fire dynamics portion of it, and you go right into the stations. You're not going to get buy-in from those students. They need to understand what fire is doing, what it's trying to do, not what it's doing, but what it's trying to do. So, yeah, I totally agree.
And there's no doubt in my mind that as I've learned this, I've made better decisions on the fire ground. There's no doubt in my mind. And I can, you know, think of a bunch of fires where I saw something happen. I'm like, you know what? Just hold that door a minute. Don't be doing anything. Nobody take any windows. Just hold on. We got a line right here. Give me a minute, you know, or we had, it was a wind impacted fire I had where I basically changed the chief's mind by what I saw. And what I saw was advantageous to us, not a detriment to us. And I just had to convince him of that just a little bit, which I did. And then he allowed us to do that with the fire, and we put the fire out, you know, and that was all good. And afterwards he goes, I've never heard anybody say that before. I said, chief, I just told you what I saw and I knew it was a positive. And he goes, I agree. So anyway, that was all because I understood the dynamics of the building and what the fire was wanted to do.
And you helped his Rolodex. He probably didn't have what you were seeing in his Rolodex. And now you've helped him.
And trust. You've got to have trust. Right. The firefighter and the officers have to trust the chiefs, and the chiefs have to trust the line officers and the firefighters.
That's so much easier said than done, though, you got to admit.
100%. But the way you start that is line officers should be sitting down with chiefs, or the chiefs should be going to the firehouses and getting to know people.
Yes.
And once you get to know people, now you kind of know what makes them tick. Like, I know the chiefs in the 1st and 3rd Division. I know the ones that when they hear about 2 minutes of silence, or maybe even less than that, of silence on the radio, not good.
Yeah.
That means, what's going on up there, fellas? Somebody give me something. Even a simple, chief, we're on a 38th floor. We're on a 31st floor. We have a light smoke condition. We're trying to figure out what apartment it is. Now at least he knows they're up there doing something. Not, maybe they're not on the 31st floor. Maybe they're on the 35th floor, whatever. Right. You give them something just to give them, you know, peace of mind that you're working in the right direction. You know?
Right.
Wow. So that's all. Yeah. Good stuff.
Well, Cap, thank you so much for being on my show. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. We'll do it again.
Guaranteed. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.